And finally, it got so long and it got so involved, the Japanese company said, well, I'll tell you what, if you don't accept our offer, then you two guys are immediately fired and we'll take the company.
It's Ohm's Law, a podcast about the visionaries, entrepreneurs, and the artists that shape our music and how we listen to it. I'm Paul McGowan. Join me as we get to know some of the most interesting people in the world of music. On today's program, Arnie Nudell, co-founder of Infinity Systems. At one time, Infinity was the largest loudspeaker manufacturer in the world. Arnie's is the story of how an aspiring laser physicist, obsessed with music and loudspeakers, changed the world of high-end audio forever. And it all started when he was a boy growing up in Southern California on a diet of opera and classical music.
I began being very interested in music around 7 or 8 years old because I had some friends and my family take me to hear the operas at the Music Center in Los Angeles. I was so stunned and impressed with the opera. It happened to be Tosca. I wanted to see more and more and more, and the friends and my family started buying tickets. So every year when the San Francisco Opera came down to Los Angeles, they dragged me along, and I loved it.
And how old were you?
7, 8, 9, something like that, very young.
Well, did any of your friends, any of your 7 or 8 year old friends listen to opera? I mean, wasn't that unusual?
Yeah, it was very, none of my friends, no. We were playing baseball and everything else, but no opera.
I can imagine. I can only remember what I was doing when I was 7 or 8 years old. It certainly wasn't listening to opera.
Yeah, you probably don't want to tell me over the air here.
Definitely not. So, did you play an instrument?
Yes. About 8 years old, 7 or 8, I started taking clarinet lessons. And after about a year of playing the clarinet, I loved it. My grandparents, who were not very rich, put some money together and bought me a brand new Buffet clarinet. And the Buffet clarinet is one of the best clarinets in the world, and I still have it.
Did your home have a hi-fi system?
It had hi-fi systems when I started to monkey with it and rewired, of course.
And how old were you when you did that?
Oh, about 9 or 10.
So let me get this straight. At 9 or 10 years old, after you'd been introduced to the opera, you started rewiring your parents' stereo?
Yes. On La Brea Avenue, there used to be one electronic shop after another. And I used to visit those shops once every week. I started buying parts and speakers, so I started installing new speakers in the audio systems that they had. I mean, that system that they had played music, obviously, but it didn't play music like I was hearing when I was listening to opera. So I began hating the sound.
And what did your parents think about you messing with their stereo?
They hated it. But I did it when they were gone, and then when they came back, I turned it on and it played, and they were a little happier.
What kind of music did you play on the stereo?
Opera and symphonic music, classical music.
At 9 years old?
At 9 or 10 years old, yeah, sure. My interest always was in music, and the other interest I had was in astronomy. And I decided that I was going to be an astrophysicist. Well, it turns out that, you know, going through a lot of college and so forth, that astrophysics wasn't it for me, but nuclear physics and laser physics was. The discovery of a laser was so exciting for me that I decided to stop school at that point and pursue laser physics because I really understood it, because I happened to be there at the time that it was discovered. Litton Industries in the San Fernando Valley. They were looking for a person to try to make a laser coupled to the inertial navigation system for the F-4D aircraft. I suggested that we could marry the two and make sure that the F-4D aircraft would not be shot down because the laser could spot the ground in a much more accurate way than just the inertial navigation system. So we put it on the F-4D aircraft after much testing. Unfortunately, I had to do all the testing in one of their small aircrafts, and I hated it, but we had to do it. And once the laser rangefinder got to the F-4D aircraft, it would never shot down. And John Ulrich was in that group.
That's how you know John Ulrich. Well, tell me about John.
Well, John was also interested in really into music. I mean, just like I was. Except the music was different.
How so?
Well, he was interested in all of the rock and roll and all the stuff that I never listened to. But his involvement in music was like mine. And he was an electronics engineer, very talented.
So how did you transition to building speakers?
Well, building speakers is probably in my blood, even from an early age. And I was looking at all kinds of hi-fi. I had all kinds of hi-fi in my house. I bought amplifiers, speakers. I tried to make speakers on speakers. I used Bozaks. I used electrostatic Jansen speakers. I still couldn't get what I wanted.
Which was what?
Was a speaker that sounded like music that I hear when I go to live music. And he was working in that group on the laser rangefinder also, and he and I got together at night and decided we both didn't like speakers as they were, and we got together to try to make a better speaker.
Why? Why did you decide to do that?
Because both of us needed it. I don't know if I can tell you anything more than that. I've been working so long putting speakers on speakers, amplifiers on amplifiers. I wanted to make something that was in my head that I believe would be better.
And what were you comparing it to that day? What were the speakers?
I was comparing it to big Bozak systems. I was comparing it to KLH-9s. I was comparing it to all kinds of high-end stuff. And I understood some of them had some virtues and a lot of them didn't. One of the things that we were doing for sure is making a servo woofer. Since we were working on the inertial navigation system, there were a lot of servo systems in that, and we decided that we were going to make a woofer with feedback. Now, we looked through the literature and didn't really find anything, so we decided to have a special speaker made with windings on the voice coil, and these windings would detect, as the speaker moved, the velocity of the speaker.
Why would you do that?
Because normal woofers with holes in the back, which are bass reflexes, and even speakers that are in sealed cabinets, have a variety of problems and cannot reproduce bass properly. We took measurements and found out that they were all wrong, and the only way that we could see to make a speaker behave properly is put a good servo system on it, an amplifier and a servo system. And when we finally did this, we compared it with a big Klipshorn with a 15-inch woofer, a 4/3 Klipsch. And that was my standard at the time, that 4/3 Klipshorn. Bigger than a normal Klipshorn because it was 4/3 the size. When we finally got a servo woofer working, we played it against that 4/3 Klipshorn. And the Klipshorn was then retired.
Now, Klipsch at the time, they were the big guys, weren't they?
Yeah, they were pretty big. Yeah, sure.
Was JBL ever a contender?
No.
Because
we didn't think anything sounded like music with JBL.
Oh, even the fabled corner horns and...
No, didn't make it. We were into more exotic stuff like electrostatics and ionic speakers and things like that. And we figured by putting some of those things together with a servo woofer that we'd be able to reproduce music in a much closer way than anything out there that existed at the time.
So you mentioned electrostatics.
What about them?
For the listeners that don't know what an electrostatic is.
Well, an electrostatic is a speaker that has two electrodes and a diaphragm in the middle. And by driving these electrodes at high voltage, it made the diaphragm in the center, which is a conductive coating, but conductive in a different way than just a wire. You would put different voltages on those electrodes that surrounded the diaphragm, and the diaphragm would move as a consequence.
And that was better than just a regular cone speaker?
Well, when you listen to a Janssen electrostatic at that time, or you listen to a KLH-9, yes, sir. They were very, very much more accurate than any of the other kinds of speakers for mid-range and tweeters.
And they were faster, too, weren't they?
Much faster. Much lower distortion, also.
So, if memory serves correct, you married an electrostat and a servo woofer together, and...
That was the servostatic one, yes.
And what year was that, Arnie?
Maybe 66... 67.
And you made a couple of pair of those and just played them at home?
Made a couple pair of them, played them at home, decided that we had what was necessary, and we were very happy, you know, with what we had. And, you know, we went back to what we were doing before, and we were approached by an electronics company that was doing most of the electronics for Litton Industries. And they heard about our speaker, and when they heard the speaker and saw what it was about, they asked us if we wanted to start a company. And I didn't think anything about that, because we didn't do this to start a company. We did this because we wanted something better. And all of a sudden somebody says, "You want to start a company? We'll finance it for you."
And you and John said, yes?
Well, John and me were taken aback at that time. That was not the idea of all of this, and it was a new idea that was put in front of us. So we thought about it, and we, of course, asked us questions about how many could you sell. Well, we knew that the Servostatic One could sell a lot, because we had a system in a high-end audio store in Woodland Hills, California. And this guy was selling more than we could actually make.
Well, now, wait a minute. I got lost here. So you were already making speakers, and you'd already gone to a dealer?
Well, no, we were not really manufacturing. We were making one at a time, and we were getting like maybe five speakers a week. The odd thing about this is that, sure, we did put it in the high-end store, but the speakers had to sell for $2,000. Now, $2,000 at that time buys a Volkswagen. And this guy in Woodland Hills was selling them so fast that we couldn't keep up with them. So we knew that there was an appeal, and people had money to spend on something new, like the Servostatic One. When we saw that, and then in that in conjunction with the offer to create a company, we decided to go and start Infinity.
Now, where did you meet Carrie Christie?
Oh, I don't remember where we met him, but he was a hi-fi guy, and somehow we connected, and he showed us some of the woodwork that he was doing, and, you know, he knew some engineering, so we hired him, and he made them by hand.
So he was your first employee?
Yes. And he got a small part of the company also, because he was at the beginning.
So now it's the three of you.
Yeah, Infinity Systems, Inc.
Is this still in your garage, or did you have a place?
No, we actually found a little place in Chatsworth, a real small place, so we could, you know, spread out and make the speakers.
And how many dealers did you have at this time?
Well, we had one. So I knew about a bunch of other dealers, like Mel Schilling in Philadelphia and so forth. And the word got around about these Servostatic Ones. So Mel called me and said, "I want some." I said, "Okay, Mel, that's fine." So I shipped him some, and then he calls up and said, "I need more." And I knew rather rapidly that, you know, the Servostatic is not going to make a company. It's only going to be a beginning for a company.
Why couldn't you have just kept making it?
We did, but that couldn't be the only product. So the next product down is everybody was so excited about, you know, this kind of thing. We made a bookshelf called the 2000A,
where we had electrostatics down the side through a passageway with a cone mid-range that I designed and a transmission line woofer.
And what did that retail for?
That retailed for $279, to be specific.
And still just the three of you making those?
No. As soon as we started making those, we started hiring lots of different people, helping with the servostatic, making the 2000A.
The company then had grown to what size? How many people did you have then?
The company, I can't tell you exactly, Paul, but the company grew tremendously doing that, because we then came out other speakers, 1001, and we used our electrostatic as well as we could, but I knew that electrostatic mid-range and tweeter is going to have to go to something else, because we kind of reached the point where we could not drive it any harder and we would get arcing. But I could never, unless I made the speaker as large as a door or a wall, I could never get the dynamic range of an orchestra. And of course, that was one of the precepts of the servostatic one, is to get closer to it. And we did with the servostatic one, but we couldn't go any further.
So what did you do?
Well, there was a very lucky happenstance. I was in Germany, and I was sitting in an office waiting for one of the reviewers, and I noticed the magazine, and in this magazine was a fascinating article about a certain disease that people get of their eyes, that the muscles in their eye could not keep their eye open, so their eye always closed. And some, I think, German and Japanese were able to obviate this problem with small dots of a new magnet called samarium cobalt. And this was tremendously stronger than any magnet that they could have used in the past. I mean, much stronger than Alnico or any of those magnets. And I knew that that's going to be the precursor of our speakers.
And you use that how? I would assume in a woofer.
No, not at all. We used it in a planar magnetic driver.
So this sounds like the beginning of the EMIMS and EMITS.
Exactly. That's exactly where it started.
So what is a planar magnetic speaker?
Planar magnetic speaker is a very thin diaphragm, and that diaphragm had what we would call a voice coil on it, which are strips, which current flows in those strips. And then there's a magnetic field on either side of this thin diaphragm, and as one would drive current down, this diaphragm would move in and out, and that was the beginning of a planar magnetic speaker.
And is that like a magnaplaner?
Yes, although the magnaplaners just used it single-ended for a long time, not push-pull.
So during this time, plenty of loudspeaker companies used what I would term standard drivers, like tweeters and horn mid-ranges. Why weren't those good enough for you? Why did you have to invent something new?
Well, it was just like the electrostatic. The electrostatic tweeter, in our judgment, was far better than all the other tweeters people were putting out with domes and stuff like that, and cones and a variety of different things. And none of those had the tremendous bandwidth, transient response, and openness that the electrostatic had. And now, with the possibility of making planar magnetics, we could get the same kind of sound.
But with more volume.
Much more volume.
Now, at this time, Arnie, how big was Infinity?
Infinity was growing by leaps and bounds, and I don't know how big it was, but I know as soon as we put the planar magnetic speakers, the EMIT, in other speakers, and even down to our smaller speaker, at that point, Infinity grew so large that for 2.5 years, we were the largest speaker company in the world, if you can believe that.
And so now at this point, you must have had quite a workforce that was building everything.
Oh, yeah. We were a very big company at that point. We had tremendous connection with fabulous companies in Japan that made some of our drivers, and I mean, it was a big deal then.
Now, this was before the IRS.
Oh, sure. And the IRS was never made to sell, you know, to sell.
What about the SM series and work in the PXs?
Oh, the SM series, we did a lot of business with the bases overseas. I mean, a lot of business with them all over the world. And their preference was a speaker called the SM, yes.
Now, what did SM stand for?
Sadomasochistic.
Good. We got it on tape. But officially...
That speaker could play a jet plane at the same loudness in a demonstration in a showroom, the big SM speaker.
I remember hearing a demo of a 747 passing overhead.
That's it. That's the one.
And that was the SM series. That was officially the studio monitor series, but...
Yes,
but internally, it was the sadomasochistic speaker.
And to the guys over there, it was the sadomasochistic, not studio monitor.
And did the original company still own part of Infinity?
Yes.
At one point, you sold and then you changed owners, if I remember correct.
Yeah, we sold it to Harman International.
Tell me about that, because there's all kinds of stories of brass balls. And,
oh, brass balls. Well, some of us had them and some of us didn't.
Well... So that was a...
Come on, laugh, Paul.
Well, I remember going up in front of Sidney Harman, and my balls were shaking.
They certainly were. They were rattling across the room. I had to get you out of there.
Well, you did, and...
Yeah, but on the other hand, I mean, let's not make something out of it. To go in front of Sidney Harman was a very challenging situation for most people.
Well, tell me about Sidney Harman.
Well, I mean, look, he was a great businessman. He was very, very stern about, you know, how things should be done. Very few people in Harman International talked back to him. But there were a few, and one of those people was me, because I wasn't going to upset a fabulous distribution that Infinity had and go into these large chains that would immediately cut our volume and profitability. And Sidney couldn't see it because he wasn't in it like I was. And, you know, I just said, Sidney, this is our distribution. We are making profit, and this is what it's going to be. And I guess nobody spoke to him like that. And I said, I'm doing it for the company. I'm not doing it for anything else. So he just said, okay, go.
Why did you make the decision to sell the company to Harman?
We felt that it was getting so big that we really had to be a part of a larger organization for it to ultimately be manageable, frankly.
And was it a tough negotiation?
Oh,
tell me about it.
No, there's nothing to tell about that. It's just that we made the deal, and for the longest time, when I say the longest time, for 5 or 6 or 7 years, Infinity thrived. We were doing car speakers. Harman had an organization called...
Harman Motive.
Harman Motive. And we spent a lot of time with Harman Motive designing speakers for Chrysler and other cars. And we got royalties on all of those things, and, you know, we were just, we were rolling in cash. At this point, by the way, a Japanese company was sitting up the street in a room trying to buy the company, and Harman International was also sitting up the street ready to buy it. And then we were sitting listening to the explanations of what the future would be for Infinity with the Japanese company and Harman International. And finally, it got so long and it got so involved, the Japanese company said, well, I'll tell you what, if you don't accept our offer, then you two guys are immediately fired.
You're fired. You're fired. You're fired. You're fired. You're fired. You're fired.
And we'll take the company.
You're fired. You're fired.
So I stood up and said, well, if that's exactly what you want to do, that's fine. Kerry, get up. We're walking down to our offices, and I guess we'll start cleaning them out now. So Kerry was shaking like a leaf. And, you know, with these guys, you can't show any weakness at all, as you know. And so I pulled him up, and we walked down the street. Carrie said, you know, if Infinity's going to be gone, it's going to be a lost entity. And I said, Carrie, don't even think about that. That will never happen this way. Anyway, he tended to believe me, and of course, an hour went by, and they came back, and they said, we give up.
Tell me about the Infinity IRS.
Well, that was something because we had thought for a long time that we could really make something that illustrated the sound of a symphony orchestra or a large rock band in a better way than anything else. So we decided that we were going to try to put together something like this. We built the IRS, and the CES was in McCormick Place in Chicago. We had two rooms downstairs, rather large rooms, and I ordered two rooms because I knew that if anybody was next to us, they'd never be able to sell anything because it would be too loud. And we had two things there that were incredible. We had two tape recorders and two series of master tapes. Telarc was one of them. We had all their things like the Firebird and all those tremendous bass things. And yes, and the other one was Keith Johnson.
Sure, Reference Recordings.
And we had all his master tapes. And we made a program out of both of them. And of course, here is this huge speaker that was 7.5 feet tall with EMIMs going down the front and EMITs tweeters going down the front and all these powerful amplifiers driving it and these wonderful tape recorders were playing, you know, fabulous music into it. I mean, the best music that you could find around by far. And the interesting thing about it is that word got around that we were doing this at McCormick Plaza, and every day there was a line around the building waiting to hear this. Carrie and I were very happy, and we decided to drive to Las Vegas. And one of the pathways is long, right through the desert. And highway was perfectly smooth. And Carrie was driving a Pantera, hopped up, and I was driving a Ferrari. So we were, you know, head and tail, going down this driveway very quickly. We were going so fast that a helicopter hovered over us, and the helicopter landed in front of us, fortunately.
This is on the highway.
This is on the highway, and there was nobody else on the highway except Carrie and me. And then we were surrounded by police cars with their, blinding lights. And they came out, and they pulled Carrie over, and they gave him a ticket. And, he just sat in his car sulking. And then they grabbed me, because I was ahead of them and probably driving faster, and gave me four tickets. And they said that if you were going 10 miles an hour faster, we would have thrown you in jail.
Hey, brother. Hey, come here, Slick. Huh? Hey, you look hip, man. Hey, you want to make yourself $5, man?
Yeah, brother.
Hey, look here. Run this car speed for me right quick, okay? Run this car speed for me. Hey.
Tell me about Infinity's foray into electronics. I remember a preamplifier. I remember a Black Widow turntable arm.
We were very successful initially trying to make better kinds of equipment. For example, concurrent with the production of the Servostatic One, we were making a switching amplifier. And switching amplifiers were right on the edge of being able to be made. I think Sony made one, and we made one that was going to be a really good amplifier for the Servostatic One, which it was. You know, after the Servostatic One, we thought that we had some really good ideas to make other kinds of products that were as earth-moving as like the Servostatic. And some were, and some weren't. Most probably weren't.
And And then you made the Black Widow tone arm.
We made the Black Widow tone arm because we felt that these heavy tone arms on these light cartridges really, that doesn't mesh. It doesn't work. And I was a cartridge freak in those days, and, you know, I had every cartridge in the world. And we decided that, you know, an SME arm is a great arm, but not for a very light cartridge. And so we decided to use carbon fiber or some carbon, and we called it the Black Widow because it was obviously black, and it made tracing of these very light cartridges a much better way. These moving coil cartridges sounded much better with the light arm, as you might guess. We then became number one in tone arms around the world.
With that single tone arm?
With that Black Widow tone arm, one Black Widow tone arm.
And you designed it?
Actually, Kerry Christie designed it, not we.
So you've had a great deal of success, certainly during the Infinity Times, and you had the largest speaker company in the world. Thinking back on it, if you had to do it over again, what were some of the mistakes that you made?
See, I don't like to do that because if one is really successful and one had the kind of life that I had, you know, which was, I mean, it was almost StarCast, that kind of life. And, you know, I was so fortunate and I was so lucky in some cases. You know, it's nice to say you make your own luck, and I believe that. But there is another quality that seems to seep in sometimes that in addition to the luck you make, you're lucky to boot. And that was how my life had been. So I would never go back and say, oh, I should have done this and I should have done that. Now, there were other people in the company that did that. But I just, that was not the way I felt about any of that.
When a speaker that you're designing doesn't sound like what's in your head, what do you do about it? How do you fix that?
In simple terms, I got to find out what's wrong. And that's not an easy job. I also know that certain kinds of drivers now, be it mid-range or bass or tweeters, I know what a lot of these things sound like. And I know that, for example, I like some of the new tweeters that are coming out, but what we had to do is use them a lot in a line or change some of the parameters of the tweeter. You know, those are things that one learns over the years that you've been doing it. Remember, I've been doing this for how many years? I don't know, 50, 60 years. And that's a long time. So I do have a pretty good handle on what things sound like and why they sound that way and what how speakers should measure or not and what they should sound like.
You have for many, many years used only tube equipment inside of your references. And that's because it sounded more like music to you?
Very good tube equipment for the longest time, in my judgment, just sounded like real music. Things have changed a bit now, and which is good because I think it's very important that, you know, if you can make something better and it happens not to be totally tubes, that's perfectly acceptable. In fact, that's much better because that means technology is rolling along and we're not stuck in just a given framework.
Do you still attend live concerts?
I'm just on the process of going to 10 concerts right now.
And where are these?
Well, we have a wonderful festival here in Vail, Colorado, and it's called Bravo, Colorado. And we have three interesting orchestras like the Dallas Symphony Orchestra, the Philadelphia Orchestra, and the New York Philharmonic. So we have our fill of really good music here. And my friend Bascom King comes up for a couple weeks, and we both go to a large number of concerts. And when we're not doing concerts, we're playing with audio.
Arnie, you're still very much active in speaker designing. And what's the future hold for you?
I love designing speakers. And when your passion is in something like that, there is a chance that with that passion and what you've done in the past, that maybe you could continue what you've done and maybe make something better. And when I say better, I mean, nobody has made a perfect speaker yet. There's a lot of expensive speakers out there, but I think you'll all agree that nobody has really made a perfect speaker. Now, I'm not suggesting I can either, but maybe I can take another step toward that perfect speaker. And my good friend Paul McGowan is probably going to give me that chance with PS Audio.
Yeah, you bet. We're looking forward to it.
Speakers is my passion, and that's why I spoke about it. And I can't wait to start.
That's great. Well, Arnie, I want to thank you for being with us. It was really appreciated.
Well, Paul, it is my pleasure, and you know I mean that sincerely.
That's our show for today. I hope you enjoyed our time together. Ohm's Law is brought to you by PS Audio, a company dedicated to great sound in service of music. This is Paul McGowan, inviting you to join us for more podcasts of Ohm's Law, available on our website, psaudio.com/podcasts, iTunes, or wherever you download your favorite podcasts. You can tweet us at PS Audio or email us, ohmslaw@psaudio.com.